From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There are plenty of big executive paychecks in America, but big million-plus pay packages for college presidents can still turn heads. Lots of students and families are struggling to pay tuition. Lots of grads are still in debt. Lots of adjunct professors are just scraping by. But the latest listing shows 42 private college presidents with million-dollar-plus pay packages, some way plus. This hour on Point, we're looking at the pay at the top for college presidents. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What should a college president make? And if the job is like a CEO's, should they command CEO-like salaries? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Big new listing is out at the top, University of Chicago President Robert J. Zimmer. Here he is in March at the university's convocation.
Today's ceremony, then, is also about reflecting upon the whole of what we do across the many libraries, laboratories, and classrooms that make up our campus. And in addition, it affords us all a moment to reflect upon the accomplishments of our past and the opportunities of our future, individually, collectively, and institutionally.
Sounds pretty good, and he should. Robert Zimmer, University of Chicago, at the top of the latest listings for pay packages for private presidents put together by the Chronicle of Higher Education. His package, $3.358 million. In the most recent year they've put this together for, 2011, $3.358 million. Joining me now from Washington is Jack Stripling, senior reporter covering college leadership and presidential compensation for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He helped to put together the big survey of college president salaries. We've got a link to the whole list at our website, onpointradio.org. Jack Stripling, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks. Great to be with you. Love your show.
Thanks very much. So give us a sense of what you found. 42 now of these presidents, over a million. Is that a change? What's the trend line here over years, Jack?
Yeah, I mean, there were 42 making over a million, up from 36 last year. We see pretty incremental increases in that group. And, this is up. If you look at the median total compensation, the folks right there in the middle, your typical private college president makes a little over $410,000 a year, and that's up about 3% from the prior year. So 3 to 5% a year growth in that area is pretty typical in recent memory.
So help us make sense of these numbers, sort of pick these apart for us. There's Bob Zimmer at the top with $3.3 million. Mm-hmm. Joseph Aoun at Northeastern University, our backyard here, in the second place on your list at $3.1 million. Dennis Murray, Marist College, $2.6 million. Lee Bollinger, Columbia, $2.3 million. And right on down it goes. Those are very big numbers. But some of this is what the special retirement packages rolled into a single year. What's going on with the top of this list?
Yeah, I mean, colleges are at great pains to remind us and remind anyone who looks at this that behind these big numbers are usually a longer story. And this has to do with the way that the IRS counts money, if you will, for private nonprofit institutions like colleges and universities. So if you look at a case like Zimmer, who's making $3.4 million in 2011, it is true that that is how much money he collected in that year. What Chicago would really want me to point out, and that we should point out, is that, you know, about 40% of that money is money that he earned in prior years that was only paid out to him in 2011. And let me unpack that a little bit if I can.
Mm-hmm.
Very common to presidential contracts is deferred compensation. And what this basically means is that in any given year, a college will set aside, let's say for the top players, a few hundred thousand dollars a year. And they'll say, all right, you know, Dr. Zimmer, you're doing a great job. We're going to give you $100,000 a year and squirrel it away to be invested. And then in 2011, we'll give you all that money, you know, 3 or 4 years of those $100,000 payments. And it's a retention tool for presidents. If Zimmer walks before a certain date, he probably doesn't get that money. And so it's a way, Ray Cotton, who I know you'll have one later, mm-hmm. often refers to this as the golden handcuff. I mean, it's a way of keeping a person around who's, you know, in the real high talent strata, like a Rob Zimmer. So that's a part of what drives this, and it's what drives colleges crazy. because they're saying, look, he didn't make this money all in 1 year, this is over time. But the fact of the matter is there's a material difference between the day Zimmer takes home that money and the theoretical years before when he was earning it.
So fair enough. That explains some of the really big numbers up into 3.3, 3.1, 2.6. On the other hand, it's still compensation, and you've still got just big numbers in here anyway. I mean, just on base pay, you've got $1 million plus at Yale. This is Richard Levin was still president at that time, $1.5 million at Amherst, 1.2 at NYU. It's not as though there's a begging bowl in these college presidents' hands. How do trustees explain what's driving the upward trend in college president compensation?
Well, I mean, they will always blame the other guy, right? I mean, they what you hear a lot is we look at our peer institutions, and so if everybody is raising, salaries for college presidents, then every time you look at your peers to keep up with them, you've got to pay more, and that's essentially what we see happening. Now, you know, to unpack this a little further, you know, one thing that we talk about quite a bit in the Chronicles piece that came out a couple days ago is that complexity of institutions is a big driver. So it's not a surprise that, you know, if you look at a place like Chicago, I mean, yeah, he made $3.5 million, let's say, in 2011, but the budget there is more than $3 billion. And so their argument would be these are complex enterprises. We have relationships with national laboratories, and you often, I mean, you hear ad nauseum, these are 24/7 jobs. They're different than they were back in the quaint days when, you know, a college president would retire to his quarters and smoke a pipe after 6 o'clock. These guys are out there, you know, pounding the pavement, raising money.
And still, the numbers are big. Northwestern, $1.3 million. Boston University, right here where I am, $1.3 million. Cooper Union, $1.3 million. When these lists come out, do the trustees run and hide? I mean, because you know people are hurting paying all of the tuition out there at the other end of the pipeline.
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting following the evolution of how colleges respond to our analysis. We see more and more institutions year after year do preemptive strikes. They put out long press releases that they distribute internally to their faculty, staff, and students, and it's usually all filled with the types of things I just told you. This is a complex place. This money wasn't all earned in 1 year. The feeling you get is that trustees and PR people would say, if the people only understood compensation, they wouldn't get mad about it. Now, I think that the public is pretty smart and can understand this stuff. And I think that, you know, in a time when tuition is going up and faculty aren't getting raises at the pace that they think they deserve, these guys are easy targets. And that certainly happens on campuses. And it's a hell of a lot more of a problem for somebody who's already vulnerable. So you look at somebody like John Sexton at NYU. He's just had a really rough year. He's had really big problems with his faculty. There was a no-confidence vote and, you know, all different types of things. This is just one more thing that he has to deal with and explain.
Now, $1.473 million when you're in trouble is tough.
Exactly, exactly. So I think that for people who are not in hot water to begin with, you know, sometimes this isn't as big a problem. But if you've got a vulnerability on one flank, this really can be tough.
Now, these are for private colleges. Your list of 42 over a million plus. Yeah, this is in 2011, the most recent numbers. What about on the public university side? Do you have any in that realm?
Yeah, we do. You see the occasional, you know, we see a handful of presidents every year making over $1 million in public colleges. That really dates back to, I mean, some of your listeners probably know Gordon Gee. He's probably one of the few household name presidents in
Ohio.
And, yeah, he was at Ohio State for a number of years. And this really dates back to his hire at Ohio State a number of years back. He was at Vanderbilt, a private college. The trustees at Ohio State wanted him bad enough that they said, look, we're going to pay you like a private president to come to a public institution. And that was really a game changer. Once that happened, we saw more and more presidents in the public sector making over $1 million. Now, granted, it's nothing close to the number that we see in the private.
What is it, just 5 or 6 nationally, I think?
Yeah, that's correct.
Do they pull out the athletic coach argument here? Hey, the basketball coach makes, I don't know how many million. The football coach makes $5 million. The president ought to make $1 million.
You know, I don't think the colleges, when they're cornered on things about excess, want to start pointing to athletics as a way of explaining the case. So I haven't heard that much.
Excess may not justify excess, if that's what it is. And there's the number. I mean, at the other end, you see more and more talk about adjunct professors being used to actually teach classes, and they may get paid a couple of thousand, $2,000-$3,000 to teach a whole semester. You know, I've seen somewhere numbers where they take home like $19,000 a year. That's a rough comparison too, Jack.
Right. I mean, I do think that that economic divide on a campus itself is something that a lot of institutions struggle with and struggle to explain. I mean, the last time we took a real close look at, you know, pay of presidents versus professor, I think, was a couple years ago. And, you know, the average president made about 3.5 times what a full professor on their campus makes. But we had a group that made 10 times what a full professor made. And, you know, that level of inequity is something that is difficult for boards to explain. And like you say, it becomes all the more pronounced. Now, we're just talking about versus full professors, not much less adjuncts. I mean, those numbers would be, the divide would be enormous. But that gets to a whole larger conversation about the business model for higher education going forward and how dependent it is on people who are, you know, not on the tenure track. That's really a whole nother issue.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the growing list of college presidents making $1 million plus. When students and families are widely struggling to pay tuition, hear from University of Pennsylvania, the president, Amy Gutman, talking to her, congratulating Penn's graduating class at commencement in May. Her compensation, $2 million plus.
Today is your celebratory day. I know you will go forth avid in your obligations to serve as citizens. Certainly, we will always be proud of how your Penn education taught you to relish the joys of great citizenship. And you can be sure that I will be avid in my admiration of you.
They're avid, she's avid, everybody's avid. The pay package looks pretty good at $2 million plus at Penn, but it's high at many private colleges these days. Trustees say, well, here are the reasons, and lay them out. We'll hear those. Others look at the whole picture and say, does this add up? Jack Stripling is with us from the Chronicle of Higher Education. He put the big list together, helped do it. Jack Stripling, stand by in Washington. I want to bring in a couple of voices on this who are right in the middle of how college presidencies work, hiring and compensating and universities overall. With us from Washington is Raymond Cotton. He's a partner at the law firm Mintz, Levin, and vice president for higher education of ML Strategies, LLC. He negotiates compensation packages for college presidents, provosts, and others, both on behalf of the college and the candidate. Raymond Cotton, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for having me.
And with us from New York, Claire Potter joins us, professor of history at the New School. She writes the tenured radical blog at the Chronicle of Higher Education and has thought and written a lot about compensation in the American university and college setting. Claire Potter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's great to be here.
Raymond Cotton, you know the simple formula. I mean, you step back and know how much debt students leave college with now, how families and students struggle, how little some adjunct professors and others make at the college campus. People may look at this list and say, wow, that sounds rich. You work right in the middle of it. Tell us how this kind of compensation comes to be, Ray.
Yes, I'd be happy to do it. Let me preface it by saying I'm a parent of 4 children. 3 have already graduated from college and 1 is still in.
So you know the paying end of this too.
I certainly do.
Mm-hmm.
But let's take a look at the bigger picture here. I've been doing this kind of work since 1981. And over that period of time, I've worked with over 350 institutions around the country, public, private, small, and large. We have a situation today where the baby boomers are retiring in droves. As they retire, boards get into the marketplace looking for replacements, and what they see is that the talent pool is very shallow. So we see at the same time, majority of trustees today come from the business world, and they bring with them their business approach to things and their business values. What I see sometimes are boards getting into bidding wars with each other for the available talent. We have an imbalance in the mm-hmm. marketplace of supply and demand. And when that occurs, if you remember from Economics 101, the price goes up And that's what we're seeing here.
Why do you think there's a shallow talent pool for candidates for college presidencies? I know it may be a tough job, but, you know we have problems with our education system. We're told at the bottom, but we're also told we put out some pretty great people at the top. We've got a lot of managers in this country. What's so tough about finding a good college president?
Well, that's a great question. By and large, boards favor hiring people from inside academia. Right or wrong, they tend not to promote from within their own university. And so when they look around the nation to say, well, who's the president of a smaller college that we can recruit that person away, or what about a provost somewhere, there have been articles, including articles in the Chronicle, where highly qualified provosts say they don't want to move up. They like where they are, and that's as high as they want to go. We have that issue. We have provosts themselves who are retiring. And so, again, when you boil it all down to who's left, that the boards, you know, boards are risk averse. They do not want to take chances on bringing someone in as a president. And they refer to the presidents oftentimes as CEOs, chief executive officer of the university. They do not want to take a risk, any more risk than they have to, on bringing someone in to do a very difficult and complex job, as Jack Stripling earlier alluded to.
Well, tell us about that job. I can just imagine people listening, thinking about these numbers that sound pretty big and thinking, well, how tough can it be? What's a college president do these days? What are the main responsibilities that make it such a hard-to-recruit-for position, you say?
Great, yes. I ask boards what they're looking for when they get into searches. And what they typically tell me in different words, but it comes out the same way, these are the top three qualities that the boards are looking for. Number one, always number one, the ability to raise substantial amounts of money, because boards, you know, are very sensitive to the tuition issue as well. The more money a president can raise, the more they can keep the university can keep the tuition down. So number one, a skill is the ability to raise money. Number two is the ability to manage the institution. And we're talking about a complex institution whose goal is to educate people, conduct research, and provide service to the community, the state in which they're located, and the nation. And then number three is the ability to get along with the faculty. Boards, you know, want to focus on the business issues of the university. They don't understand really faculty issues, and they want to leave that to the president and the president's staff, including the provost. So those are issues that boards do not want to get involved in. So this sort of complex mix of talents are unusual, and people who have these skills and have demonstrated success in all of these areas are quite frankly not numerous. And on the other side, keep in mind that the available openings continue to grow as more and more presidents retire.
Claire Potter, you're listening to All This in New York. You're there at the New School. You've written a lot about this. These are big institutions. You got to raise money and manage a big institution and deal with faculty, prickly faculty. So a million plus, no problem. Quite appropriate. What do you say, Claire?
Well, I think it's inappropriate. And I think one of the questions that university presidents ought to ask themselves, maybe in some room where the board is not sitting there with them, is what's a university for? And how is it that we have adopted a model for universities that is from the for-profit sector for institutions that are not-for-profit, for institutions that are supposed to take a much wider view of the public good? I think, you know, it's interesting to me to listen to Ray talk because he obviously has a lot of experience about the hiring and firing and retention of university presidents. But I think there are certain things he's taking for granted that we might want to reexamine. One is the question of if the talent pool is shallow, why is that? Why is it that becoming a university president takes you into a role of being a corporate CEO when, in fact, that's not why most people go into education? I think the question of universities tending not to promote from within, that's true and it's not true. I mean, if you look at Harvard and Yale, they nearly always choose someone who is on their faculty in some way as president. And I think it's interesting, for example, that Drew Faust, who is the president of Harvard,
is not on this list, by the way. It's not
no,
on the
she's
list
not on the list. Plus, now, yeah. Take a look at that. And Shirley Tilghman, who was the president of Princeton, both of these women are making less than a third of Robert Zimmer. And yet these are some of the most highly endowed and complex universities in the nation. So the market looks kind of funny to me from my vantage point as a faculty member who, you know, only got a raise in the last 7 years by moving to another institution.
Jack Stripling, you're listening there in Washington. Is there a connection between the size of the university, the, and therefore perhaps the complexity of the job and the compensation, or not, Jack, in your list?
I think that we see outliers on either end. I mean, I think as a general rule of thumb that, you know, institutions that are larger, that have bigger budgets, pay presidents more. There are these, you know, mysterious outliers, as you say, like Drew Faust, who, I mean, I want to stress, is not exactly, you know, scraping by with $900,000 a year.
Yeah.
But that does put her outside of the top 50, and I think people find that odd, given that she's president of Harvard. As I've mentioned to a couple other people, I mean, I think there are some intrinsic benefits to being Harvard's president that probably, you know, don't exist for other college presidents. So, you know, perhaps that's, you know, that's part of a compensation that we don't measure in pure numbers. But yeah, I think there is a correlation. I also think that you had mentioned before Amy Gutman at Penn.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's to me an interesting story. If I can have a second on it,
$2 million the per package in 2011.
Yeah, she made $2 million, but that. You know, from the year before, that's an increase of about 43% in her total compensation, just
okay.
A huge jump.
Mm-hmm.
And in talking to their board chair, when I spoke with David Cohen, he said, look, we looked at the Chronicle's compensation analysis, and we were displeased to see that she was 14th on your list. We think she's the best president in the country. We think Penn is one of the most complex institutions in the country. We're talking about a place with a $5 billion budget, $5.5 billion. And so we wanted to really sweeten the pot for her. Now, what they did was they put a lot of money in deferred compensation that they say is going to be tied to her meeting some predetermined objectives.
Yeah.
Now, we in the public can't assess whether she met those or not, but we're told she did. But what that revealed to me is that you asked, do some trustees, you know, head for the hills when these numbers come out? Yes, some do. But others are very candid about the fact that this is competitive, that they want their president to be at the top of the heap. And, you know, I think professors might, you know, not be happy to hear that, but it is a competitive business, and there's a certain amount of pride that seems to be at stake here.
That's so interesting. Ray Cotton, is that the corporate culture of boards of trustees you mentioned coming into play when they say, hey, we want to drive our president's salary up the list? We want it near the top, not in the middle of the pack.
Well, first of all, I find Jack's comments very, very interesting because he has a good feel for what's going on in the marketplace. Secondly, we do compensation studies at our firm, and I can remember doing one where it was a highly compensated liberal arts college where the board said to me, we want to find out what her peers are, and we want her at the top because, they said, our main responsibilities as trustees are to attract and retain the top talent for our school. So we don't want her getting recruited out of here. And as a defensive strategy, we want her at the top of the list. So what you do find, yes, these are business people who, again, bring their business models to higher education, including the fact that when salaries and compensation are set in business, it's done according to comparable data. And today, that's what boards are interested in. That's what they want to see. They want to see what the peer institutions are paying. And usually what happens is then they talk about among themselves the performance level of their president. How is our president doing? If he or she is doing a great job, then we the board want to put her in the top quartile, the top 25%. So that's a 75th percentile or above. And so what Jack picked up from the board at Penn is something I've heard before, where boards say our president is the best and the brightest. He or she has brought in enormous amount of money to this institution. They've done this, that, and the other. And therefore, A, we want to reward that top performance, and B, we want to make sure, absolutely sure, that she cannot get recruited out of here.
Claire Potter, how does that line up with your mission-driven dream of compensation?
Well, not at all. And I think some of the people who are doing this work might want to put on a disguise at some point and come into a faculty meeting. I think it's very interesting when top talent in universities are not teachers, but administrators. And one of the things that faculty and students have been watching really over the last 20 years is increasingly the budget is being concentrated at the top. So when we're talking about the compensation for president, part of what that conversation disguises is a range of administrators who are also making in the many hundreds of thousand dollars, who are also making in the millions of dollars, who are getting this kind of deferred pay and investment through sweet real estate deals and mortgages that are being deferred. It's really kind of a scandal. And when 60% of people coming out of graduate school with a PhD in English can only expect to earn $2,500 a course and get no benefits whatsoever, frankly, college presidents have created this world. Boards of trustees have created this world, and I think they have a lot to answer for.
I mean, Raymond, doesn't it give you pause to see the people at the bottom of the pyramid of a well-functioning university being paid so little when those at the top are being paid pretty handsomely here?
Well, my own view is that professors are underpaid and need to get paid more. The question, though, that boards are, you know, I was a trustee for 4 years, and the question that kept coming to our attention was, we have X number of dollars, how are we going to spend it for, I was a trustee on a small liberal arts college. Mm-hmm. And of course, so we have limited money, how are we going to spend it? You know, I myself was a liberal arts major at undergraduate school. I want to see those English professors better paid. I want to see those history professors better paid. I want to see more courses in geography, for example. But it comes down at the end of the day to how many dollars do we as the trustees, and remembering that the trustees are the highest legal authority in every institution in the country. So, yes, the budgets are produced by the president, the CFO, and their staffs, and then presented to the board for review and approval. Absolutely, professors need to get paid more. Our professors are the best in the world, and the measure of that is that students flood into the United States to obtain education here. And why do they do that? They do that because they, and oftentimes their governments, view our education as the best in the world. So they flock here. And so, yes, I agree with Claire that professors ought to be paid more. The question is, where are we going to get the money from? We cannot continue to raise tuition.
Yeah, stand by, Ray Cotton. Jack Stripling, I know I have to let you go. Any slowing down to this trend in your assessment, Jack? I mean, are these numbers just headed on up, more presidents joining this rank?
I don't see any indication in our reporting to suggest that criticism is going to turn the tide on this. I mean, one thing I do want to mention, we haven't even talked about perks. And so when you talk about somebody making, you know, over $3 million in Chicago, let's not forget that he's, you know, also living in a house that's provided to him, that he also has a car and driver provided to him. So all the things that make up our, you know, daily lives of determining what our budgets are really off the table for somebody like Robert Zimmer.
Jack Stripling at the Chronicle of Higher Education. I know we have to let you go. Thanks for joining us today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the growing list of college presidents making $1 million plus when students and families are struggling to pay tuition. Claire Potter is with us, professor of history at the New School, writes the tenured radical blog at the Chronicle of Higher Education, not so crazy about what she sees in this trend. Raymond Cotton works right in the middle of it. He's a partner at the law firm Mintz Levin, VP for Higher Education at ML Strategies there, negotiates on behalf of colleges and candidates to be college presidents. We've got a call right here from Waterloo, Illinois. Tom's calling. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. What have you seen?
Hi, Tom. Admittedly, they are complex issues, but I thought I'd just give you the perspective of one set of parents. We have five children. The oldest of our children was actually accepted into the University of Chicago about 8 years ago as a freshman.
Yeah.
Tuition at that time, I think, was about $47,000 a year.
Yeah.
We couldn't handle it. And as I walked through their admission process, I was able to get into their admissions department. A little bit of a runaround, but finally got to somebody that would level with me. And these numbers are going to be a little bit skewed, but the point will be made.
Okay.
I asked how many freshman applicants. They had several thousand. How many did they take? About 2,000. Of those 2,000, how many got academic scholarships? Only 12. So I said to her, I get it. You don't have to give away money. You have a several billion dollar endowment. People are dying to give you their cash to get in here. My point is, she went on to have a great undergraduate career. She did a PhD program. There are plenty, plenty other good options out there for parents with higher education at a much, much lower cost, much more cost effective. That's my point.
So look around, shop around, and do you care what the guy or woman at the top is paid, Tom?
I don't think you can fully understand it as a parent. It is a complex business organization, no question about it. I don't think you have to fully understand it. It's across the country. Sure, it's a problem. Income inequality is a problem. But you can't. In our case, we had four of the kids we had to educate. I just think you have to look around, get the best deal for you. And there are plenty of opportunities out there. It's there.
Tom, we've got it. Making your way with five kids in an expensive college world, and you have to shop is the advice right there. I appreciate your call. One more here. Jan in Burlington, Vermont. Jan, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, my perspective is as someone who's done university development work, I'm a parent of a college grad, and my dad was a faculty member. So I've seen all three worlds, and I have to say that the president's pay is just one little part of it. I agree with Professor Potter that, you know, many times after presidents retire, they get faculty positions where they're paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to teach one class or not. Just happened recently with Brandeis. And, you know, the president's compensation reflects a broader drive across administrative units. I mean, that takes up a huge proportion of university budgets, while the real work of faculty teaching kids and a lot of the fundraising that comes in because of your favorite professor 20 years or 30 years later, not because of the college president. So it's this migration from a education, higher learning institution to this consumer product that's being marketed with fundraising that builds buildings and goes to bricks and mortar and other projects that have nothing to do with educating.
So you were in development. That's fundraising. Ray Cotton says you've got to have a president who's really good at that. That is in part what's being paid for here. What do you say to that, Jen?
Well, it depends what the fundraising is for. So, yes, there's fundraising, but it politicizes faculty work where academic units who have great relationships or great potential for funding, they're always in the president's office. They have accessibility. And those other academic units do not. And as a fundraiser, you're always looking outward. And so you're not looking inward, and there's an inherent conflict with faculty because the faculty units have to work with the president, and if the president's out fundraising, it can cause problems in relationships with faculty senate and other faculty units.
Jen, I appreciate your call. Claire Potter, you know, there's been talk of a higher education bubble in this country, that we've built kind of an unsustainable, very expensive style of higher education, that maybe these high presidential pay packages are emblematic of, and that it just can't go on this way. I mean, you write, at the end of a piece of yours I read recently, higher education is in need of ethical and fiscal reform, but it can't happen unless we start at the top. What about the overall dynamic here, Claire?
Well, I think the overall dynamic has been referred to by many people on the show, which is universities are being run as corporations. And corporations sell things. Universities do not sell things.
Well, don't they? Don't they, in effect, sell education? People are certainly paying handsomely.
Well, I think that's a very controversial idea. I think most faculty who are in the classroom do not see their students as customers, that the faculty-student relationship is one of development, transferring knowledge across generations, encouraging a new generation of citizens, and so on. Which I don't mean to be precious about this, but it is merely a fact that even if the university is selling things, it's selling a limited product, right? 2,000 seats a year.
Yeah.
If you've got a business school or a law school, you know, you can add a couple more thousand seats to that. Whereas if you're the CEO of Apple, you're selling iPhones. And I think part of what universities have done is identify exploitable groups. I think administrative assistants and other white-collar workers are exploitable groups. I think students are exploitable groups. I think graduate students are exploitable groups. And gradually, as you move up the ranks of faculty, more and more faculty who used to think they were beyond exploitation are beginning to get it that they've been targeted too.
And is that somehow related, in your view, to the compensation of the man or woman at the top?
Absolutely.
Why?
I think there's no question. I think it was Raymond who talked about the ways in which boards of trustees want college presidents to be like them. I think that's absolutely true. And I think
they tend to be increasingly from the corporate world these days.
Absolutely.
So what?
Well, I think it's a class issue. I mean, I think more and more, if you look at the sociology research on class, one of the things we understand about the 1% in this country is they actually don't get it how other people live, and they actually don't get it what other people's problems are. So that, for example, I think one of the most moving stories in an article in The New Yorker about NYU was the president of NYU, who has had a rough year, as we've heard, running into a student who had taken out something like, you know, $40,000 in loans for his freshman year and had said, you know, I don't think I can come back. And there are all kinds of students around the country who are not only taking out loans, who are getting their parents to take out loans. You know, a college can make you mortgage your house to send your child to school. That's a big part of the mortgage bubble no one's talking about. But these students are often also working 20, 30, 40 hours a week.
Put those things side by side, it can look tough. And yet, Ray Cotton says it's a shallow pool and people are willing to compete for that talent. Stephen in New York, Potsdam, New York. Thanks for calling, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Just what your speaker just said about colleges, we're not producing widgets. Colleges are educational institutions, and they've really lost their focus, especially when that guy said the number one reason that they're hiring a president is so that they can go out and get money. I'd also like to know, and this is this off air, is these schools that are paying these people lots of money, how many adjunct professors do they have? Because that is probably one of the biggest I just can't believe that all these colleges that are – I live in a town, $60,000 to go to St. Lawrence and adjunct professors. I'm going to get off now. Thank you.
Okay. Stephen, thanks for calling. Ray Cotton, I don't know if you follow that, but we've certainly read of more and more courses being taught by people who are not tenured, not full-time, even adjunct professors making, you know, a couple of $2,000 to teach a course. That can be particularly galling to put up against these big salaries. Is there a relationship there? If you pay more at the top, do you have to pay less at the bottom?
Not at all. Again, it's a matter of resources and how to allocate them. But I do want to get back to something I thought important that Tom brought up from Waterloo, New York, which is this. There are 3,200 institutions of higher education in the United States. Not everybody needs to go to Harvard, Yale, or Princeton. And my point is that there are many, many colleges out there, particularly in the liberal arts area, where students get an excellent education. Adjuncts are unusual, although they do exist, and the tuition is low. And in addition to that, one of the trend lines we're also seeing is that there were fewer students applying to higher ed by a small number, but fewer. Last year than the year before. And what I hear from presidents is, and from boards too, that we're for the smaller liberal arts colleges where students get excellent educations, including the one I went to, that if parents look around and see what their options are, I think that they'll do very well for their students, for their children. And in addition, we need to talk about public universities. We've been talking about the privates because that's the Chronicle study focus that Jack was talking
put
about.
Put together here, yeah.
Exactly. But the majority, over two-thirds of students are educated in public universities. And
so if you don't like it, go elsewhere. I mean, and just because you go smaller doesn't mean you've got Florida Institute of Technology here paying its president $1.8 million. Chatham University, I don't know Chatham University, but they paid $1.8 million in 2011. It's not just big-name universities who are paying large.
No, but again, as Jack mentioned, those numbers are a little bit misleading because what the Chronicle does is they report all compensation paid in the 12-month period, regardless of what it was.
Yeah.
And so a lot of that was deferred compensation that was earned over, sometimes as long as 10 years.
Let's go to Stuart in Bloomington, Illinois. Stuart, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, if we're going to reform this from the top, why aren't the majority of members of boards of trustees actually faculty members who actually know something about higher education? Because my experience with upper-level administration is they're not particularly well-educated. They have an academic management degree or something like that. And then they get into a discussion with faculty about curriculum and are literally out of their league. And so what we haven't talked about is the fact that higher education is really being run into the ground by these business-type neoliberal economic thinkers who really don't understand what they're about.
Is it possible, Stuart, that you need that kind of business management mind at the top because you've got big, complex institutions, or you just don't buy that?
I don't buy that at all. I think that culturally all over, we've been, since Reagan, bowing and scraping to people who claim to have some kind of management expertise but really have been lying in their pockets at to the detriment of the economy and to the detriment of higher ed and to the detriment of the society overall. And it's all a fiction. Just a quick anecdote. My father-in-law died. He was a dean of a medical school.
Yeah.
And great speeches were given at his funeral about what he meant to the institution. And, 10 minutes later, three guys got together in a room and hired his replacement. It's about mortality. Nobody in the world who is worth more than $150K. I mean, nobody in the world. We're all going to die. We're all going to be replaced. And it's easily done.
Stuart, you're zen. Claire Potter, how about it? Would you put faculty on the Board of Trustees? Is there not some... I mean, of course, faculty are the heart of a college, but is there something else that comes into play here when you're making the whole institution, the organization, work together? That means you need a different mentality. You need a management mentality. You need a manager who's paid a lot.
Right. Well, I would absolutely put faculty on the Board of Trustees. And if you look at some of the smaller liberal arts colleges, there are faculty on the Board of Trustees. Where I used to teach, Wesleyan University, the chairs of various university committees used to sit on the board, often alums who were in their 20s. There were seats reserved for younger people on the board and so on. I used to sit in Board of Trustees meetings because I was chair of a committee. And one of the things that I found very interesting is often members of boards of trustees are actually passionate about the institution. And they genuinely attribute all of their success to having gone to that school. So on many boards, there is no little love for the institution. What is very difficult often is to get members of the Board of Trustees actually engaged in the intellectual mission. What they want to do is they want to leave a legacy. They want to hire somebody splashy. They want to build a building. They want to raise X number of dollars, which, by the way, do not go to keeping tuition down. That is not true. But what they don't want to do is set foot in a classroom. In all of my years at Wesleyan, and I actually knew a number of members of the board very well and liked them and admired them a great deal, in 18 years, one member of a board of trustees stepped into my classroom. And that was a guy from the Cato Institute who I think wanted to know whether I was as radical as I was supposed to be.
Claire, where do you think this goes? Jack Stripling says, so far the trend line is up for college president pay and more crossing this million-dollar boundary. Where does this go, Claire?
Well, I think we need some kind of a Teddy Roosevelt person or a Warren Buffett person to stand up and say, that's an ordinary person behind the curtain here. I am embedded in something that is wrong. Teddy Roosevelt was an extremely wealthy man. He went to Harvard. He was embedded in a family that was completely wealthy. And at a certain point, walking around New York with Jacob Riis, his eyes were opened to the fact that people like him were creating misery for others. And it's hard to imagine misery as part of a college or a university. But believe me, I hear from a lot of those adjuncts. And they are sad. They are depressed. They don't really see any hope for what is going to happen to them. And I think some college president needs to take that on as an issue, as a national issue, and really show why it matters.
I'm sure nobody at the top wants to create that, but that's a picture you see. I'm sure this debate will go on as these lists come out, especially as the numbers grow, at least grow at one end of this operation. Really interesting to dig in here today, to hear the rationale, see the pushback. Claire Potter at the New School, we're grateful to you for spending the time with us. Thank you very much for your insights today.
Thanks a lot, Tom. It's nice to be here.
Raymond Cotton at Mintz Levin out there negotiating on both sides of these tables. Ray, thank you for your insights today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. A lot to think about right there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.